Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Our next guest is Matt Simon, who has written a book called The Plight of the Living Dead. Now, Simon explores how parasites have figured out how to control the minds of their hosts, from brain worms turned body snatchers to fungi invasions and wasps performing lobotomies. Plight of the Living Dead takes readers into the emerging science of zombification in the animal kingdom, revealing the diverse mechanisms and outlandish schemes that these parasites use to control their hosts' minds. It's a good time to talk about zombieism. Matt Simon, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
And thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off with your definition of zombification.
Yeah, so the zombies that we know and love in pop culture are, of course, the humans turned undead. They're bitey, generally aggressive, not very much fun for the rest of humanity. But it turns out in the animal kingdom, you find many, many, many instances of parasites that are able to take over the minds of their hosts. And I don't say that lightly. I'm not exaggerating. They are using various methods, be they chemicals or whether acting on specific structures in the brain to actually manipulate the behavior of the animals that they are sitting in to their own means, of course. And as you might expect, this never really ends well for the host itself.
Right. Well, so interesting, the many different examples you bring up in your book. But I have to say, every so often, I'll see an ant off by itself, just wandering around. And I always wondered why that was, because they have such a great social structure. But now I know it's because he's just on an acid trip. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, so it turns out that the zombie ant is one of the best studied examples in zombification in the animal kingdom. You can find these around the world. We actually have them here in the southern United States. But you'll find them more often in South America in tropical climes. So what happens is this fungus lands on the cuticle or the exoskeleton of the ant and works its way through it and then begins growing as a fungal colony inside the ant's body and ends up making up about half of the body weight of this poor ant. And about 2 weeks after infection, something splits in the ant's brain. And as you mentioned, sometimes you'll find an ant out wandering on its own. It's not supposed to be doing that unless it's a scout or if it has something like a fungus in its head, because this particular fungus orders it into a very specific spot in the rainforest. And that is always about 10 inches off the ground, biting onto the vein of a leaf hanging upside down. And the fungus always orders the ant to do this at around noon each day. It's remarkably consistent from infection to infection. So once the ant is there, the fungus is in place and kills the ant and erupts out of the back of its head as a stalk. And from that stalk rains spores down below. Just so happens that the fungus, with, of course, no mind of its own, it's a fungus, has positioned the ant above the colony's trails. And that allows the fungus to keep infecting more and more ants in the colony. So you find that in a lot of colonies out there, this is a chronic infection, something that a colony has to live with. It doesn't destroy the colony, it doesn't wipe it out, because that would be, of course, bad for the fungus. It wouldn't have any more hosts to infect if that happened. So it's a remarkably precise adaptation and manipulation that scientists are really just beginning to get a handle on. But they're out in the rainforest very often, plotting these things in the forest and seeing with remarkable consistency how the fungus is able to take over the mind of this poor little ant.
Our listeners are hearing about this book for the first time. Lynn and I have had the opportunity over the last couple of weeks to read the book, and I just wanted to comment that you have a tremendous amount of enthusiasm for this subject.
And it's hard not to.
And I was wondering, you must be a hit in a cocktail party.
Yeah, hit or a horror show, depending on your perspective, and if anybody has actually eaten yet. But yeah, it's, you know, I tried to structure the book as, you know, not only kind of a, wow, this is happening, everyone. I'm not lying to you. Scientists are studying this as an actual thing, but also to present it in a fun light. I think this is extremely extremely interesting. And to be quite honest, far more interesting than what Hollywood has dreamed up as far as zombies and the undead are concerned. These manipulations that parasites are pulling off in their host are just so astounding. And yes, sometimes very disgusting as they erupt from the bodies of their hosts and things like that. So I think I'm maybe it's a mixed bag for me at cocktail parties.
Well, we had an opportunity to book you on a number of different dates, but I had to get something as close to Halloween as possible, and I thought the timing was perfect. And I had a chance to speak to some people. We were doing this Halloween thing out on Main Street where we did a live remote, and I was talking to them because there were zombies, of course, and people that were dressed up, and telling some of the stories from the book, and people were really kind of creeped out. There's kind of thing. That really goes on in real life, and yeah, it does. And there's also a connection to humans, because we, after all, can be infected with animals that are infected with rabies and take on the rabies virus itself. And in a way, the rabies virus ends up controlling the human that is infected. Can you talk about that?
It does, yeah. It's easy to forget that. You see people infected with rabies, you can actually find this online in videos. It's an extremely difficult thing to watch because they're obviously in agony. And if you start presenting symptoms of the rabies virus, that is the foaming at the mouth a lot of times, you're almost guaranteed to perish from it. There's only a handful of people who have survived it. If you get your vaccine before you start presenting symptoms, you'll be okay usually. But it turns out that the rabies virus and its manipulation of humans is the actual inspiration for the zombie of folklore that we know and love today. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. You have that stupor, the aggression, that just general just meanness. And it's not any fault of the person, right? It's the virus in both fiction and in nonfiction in our real life. Rabies virus and the zombies virus in fiction. But yeah, this is a really fascinating manipulation, mostly because rabies wasn't meant to infect us. It evolved in other mammals. So you'll find it in things like raccoons and possums. That's where it really controls the behavior and gets them aggressive and makes them bite other animals, thus transmitting itself. And the extra fascinating thing there is that when it does induce that aggression, it also induces a fear of water in the host. And that's a manipulation to keep the host from drinking water, of course, which would then wash out the virus from the mouth that is presenting in the foam. Really interesting manipulation. But unfortunately, because we have these mammalian brains that are similar to those that the virus evolved to exploit, we fall victim to it as well. It's a very difficult thing to watch, I think largely because it deprives us of our humanity. It just turns you into an unhuman, kind of an undead type of figure. And it's really interesting to think about, well, we wouldn't have the zombie that we know and love today without that. But luckily, medicine has progressed to a point where as soon as you get your vaccine, you're usually okay, but very much a virus to fear.
Absolutely. Well, that is a very interesting everyday sort of occurrence when people are walking on the trails and if they're bit by a dog or something. I've always thought that it's a little over paranoia to go get checked for rabies right away, but not. It's not at all. I wanted to ask you about some other types of parasites and fungus that zombify their victim, that when their victim is really another insect or something, but instead it attaches itself to a human. And I opened up to a page in your book, going back to 1969, and Woodstock, and the time that crustaceans clamped onto a guy's leg hairs and began a scientific movement. What happened there?
Yeah, it was a weird time, 1960s. And this is why I love science so much, as a matter of fact. This is a really, really interesting study. There were these two gentlemen scientists. They were hanging out in some rivers and ponds and were noticing that these little crustaceans were acting funny. They would come up to the surface and kind of skitter around, acting very strange, which is stupid for a crustacean to do because you're going to get picked off by a bird. And as you mentioned, they would actually, as the men were walking through the water, would attach themselves to their leg hairs. They were attaching themselves to anything they could possibly find. When leg hairs aren't around, by the way, they'll clamp onto vegetation that's floating around. So they went to their lab and found that these specific crustaceans in this ecosystem were infected with a worm called an acanthocephalin. And this is what really kicked off the study of zombification in the animal kingdom, because what they were finding was that this acanthocephalin has a complex life cycle. It needs to get itself into the belly of a bird in order to reproduce. So it turns out that this is a very interesting manipulation on the part of the parasite to get its host up to a spot where it is best positioned to get picked off by a bird. Again, doesn't end well for the host, as is most of the cases here, but it gets the worm into the belly where it needs to complete its life cycle, the only place it can do so. And by that, they concluded that, they are manipulating the behavior of their host. And that was kind of the kicking off of this whole movement, this study in science. And it has, from that point, got all the more complex with zombie ants and wasps that do lobotomies on cockroaches. And time after time, and across the tree of life, we're finding that this has evolved separately time after time. And it's really fascinating to see how a lot of times there are different manipulations. So the zombie ant is about positioning the fungus so it can better infect the colony. But for this worm, it's about getting into the belly of another animal. So there's the same kinds of manipulation, controlling behavior, but to different ends and by different means. You have different chemicals and working on brain structures. And science is getting really good at starting to tease apart the differences here and really kind of reckoning with just how widespread this probably is. And we just have no idea.
Wow. If you're just joining us, our guest is Matt Simon. He's written a book called The Plight of the Living Dead, What Real-Life Zombies Reveal About Our World and Ourselves. And again, the fascinating thing about you, Matt, is that you're not even an entomologist. You are a science writer, a science journalist, and yet all of this information that you're presenting in your book is very, very sciencey. And so, I mean, are you sure you're not an entomologist?
Unless it was a past life, which would be hard because I don't really believe in that. But I think I'm just kind of a nerd for weird science, and in particular, weird entomology. I really deep into it. But the problem with this sort of book is that you read one paper and that just turns into another and another and another. And, you know, I got really good at decoding what is happening in these scientific papers and presenting them to a popular audience. But I also had the pleasure of going out in the field and visiting scientists and, you know, going to the hills of New Mexico and finding these worms that get into crickets' bodies and turn them into kamikaze crickets by jumping into water. That's a manipulation to get the worm into water, the only place where it can breathe. So just among the many, many examples of this. And it's hard not to get weirded out and totally enthused by it at the same time, because, again, these are the manipulations that we can see. That's the easy stuff. There may be so many more out there, these parasites that are maybe controlling the sound that their hosts make to modify their mating behavior, or the smells that they make to modify mating behavior as well. We just don't know, because we're kind of stuck in this worldview that we have as humans, as visual creatures predominantly. And it's just really interesting to think about, well, you know, we have these on paper. What else is lurking out there that is yet to be found?
Ah, that's the question. And Matt, you mentioned in the book that zombification is not just about releasing chemicals into the host bodies, and that there's other forms as well, so that some caterpillars infiltrate ant colonies by releasing pheromones that trick the workers into thinking that the pests are actually queens. Can you tell us about that?
A lot of people don't like hearing this one because it's caterpillars. We hold caterpillars in very high regard, of course, but these are carnivorous caterpillars. You might call them killer caterpillars if you like. So these are parasites of entire colonies of ants, much in the same way that the fungus does. But it's different in that the manipulation is based on several other actors. So what happens is when these Myrmica ants, this particular species, get under an oregano tree, the plant releases these alarm chemicals that attract this particular butterfly. It's called the large blue butterfly, which is an extremely uncreative name, unfortunately, but I didn't make it up, I promise. The butterfly finds these and lays her eggs, and the caterpillar hatches and works its way down to the ground, and this is where the ants find it. And they don't devour it because the caterpillar is putting off pheromones that almost exactly mimic that of the queen of the colony. So the ants come across it and pick it up and take it back as if it is their own queen. And they care for it, which is a stupid thing to do because this caterpillar then kind of squirms off and finds the larva of the colony and begins devouring them. And at this whole time, the worker ants are not really concerned by this for whatever reason, probably because they think they're very well convinced because of these pheromones that it is their queen, and they'll actually groom it like it's their own queen. So you'll also have, unfortunately, several of these caterpillars that will get into one colony and wipe out the colony completely, unlike the zombifying fungus that kind of infects ant colonies and it acts as a chronic infection. It's not too terrible. But this caterpillar is particularly bad for these ant colonies. It gets all the more interesting because there is a parasite of this parasite. There's a wasp that will also infiltrate these colonies and release its own pheromones, but they're alarm pheromones. So when the ants smell that, they freak out. They will actually bump up against the wasp, pick up those pheromones and bump against each other, and it spreads like a virus through the colony, and everybody is freaking out. While they are doing that, the wasp strolls up to one of these parasitic caterpillars, injects its own egg in the caterpillar, and that, of course, ends badly for the caterpillar because that egg hatches into a larva, devours the caterpillar alive, and the wasp just walks out. You have manipulations upon manipulations, you know, beyond us just being able to figure out what is going on here with individual species. There are parasites of parasites that are manipulating the behavior of their host. It's mind-blowingly complex, and it'll be really interesting to see in the coming decades the more scientists unravel about how these parasites are doing this to their host, but also how it's affecting things like larger ecosystems. What does this mean for colonies of ants if you have these terrible things out there? So lots of work to be done, but these are really exciting times in biology.
Well, we are at the top of the food chain, and we have major league problems like our Netflix didn't launch properly, or our boss didn't appreciate our presentation. How could she feel that way? I mean, we have other problems too, and we have some serious problems. I'm not trying to just make light of it, but I do want to make the point that it is tough when you're not at the top of the food chain. I mean, the animal kingdom is a rough place to be, isn't it?
It is very, very rough. It's very cruel. And this is something that actually really troubled Darwin. He didn't understand how a benevolent God could, and he was actually thinking about wasps that kind of do this sort of thing where they inject eggs into other critters without so much the mind control, but the cruelty of injecting another animal with your eggs that then hatch and devour the caterpillar alive from the inside. That troubled Darwin, and I think it should trouble all of us, because it really breaks down that idea that there's harmony in nature. It's not really harmony. There's balance amongst we screw up ecosystems, but that balance is based on unending cruelty. And I think a good example to bring into here for a minute, the parasite is the jewel wasp, which is cruel on a level that, I mean, that doesn't mean to be, but it's on a level that is just simply astounding. What it does is it stings a cockroach in the brain, like you do. It drives its stinger through the neck into the brain, where it feels around, because it has sensors on its stinger, feels around for two specific spots in the brain that govern locomotion, which is astounding. It has invented brain surgery, and it did so millions of years before we even thought of the thing. So when it pulls out its stinger, the cockroach doesn't run away, it doesn't fly away. It just stands there and grooms itself like an idiot. You should expect it to do, like, come on, do something. You just got stung in the brain. Fight back. But it doesn't. And because of that, the wasp can not even drag it into a burrow, but guide it into a burrow. The cockroach willingly follows the wasp to its doom. The wasp puts it in there, lays an egg on its stomach. The egg hatches the larva, which drains the juices out of the cockroach before crawling into its abdomen, hollowing out all the organs, and then pupating and erupting as an adult. So it's hard to, like, how do you level this with these ideas of the harmony of nature? There's balance, but only because these things are doing terrible things to each other. And it's difficult to not only, I had the pleasure of seeing this, the wasp do this to a cockroach in a lab in Israel. It's hard to see it, but also to write about it and to think about how this is happening day in and day out, and how we as humans are, you know, if we're lucky enough to have comfortable lives, just how lucky we are above the many other creatures in the animal kingdom that are suffering so badly.
Well, our guest is Matt Simon. The book, Plight of the Living Dead, What Real Life Zombies Reveal About Our World and Ourselves. And